May it please the court. I will be arguing points one and two of appellant's brief, and standing on the brief as submitted with respect to the remaining points. Laron Hart was 17 years old when the offense of murder in the first degree was committed. During the videotaped interrogation of 17-year-old Mr. Hart, two sets of detectives either mentioned or discussed with Mr. Hart a number of factors that allegedly influenced him in the commission of the offense. The detectives talked with him about the influence of peer pressure on Mr. Hart, how he had the absence of a strong male role model in his home, the difficulty of growing up, and how hard it is for youth to make good decisions when in negative crime-ridden environments. And lastly, the detectives talked about Mr. Hart's own failure to appreciate the consequences of his actions. Coincidentally, the United States Supreme Court in Miller v. Alabama mentioned some of these very same factors in finding that a mandatory, non-parolable life sentence for juveniles is unconstitutional. Mr. Hart received a mandatory, non-parolable life sentence that is now unconstitutional per Miller v. Alabama. And now the question is, what to do with his conviction, if anything, and what penalty, if any, to impose for any conviction, should it stand? Now, as this court well knows from the arguments that preceded me, there are two ways of approaching the issues that are presented in these cases. The two ways are somewhat contradictory to one another, but Mr. Hart and I, not knowing which way the court would decide, we have, for the court's benefit, argued both of the alternatives. The first alternative is that Section 565.020.2, the first-degree murder statute, is not severable, that the unconstitutional penalty provisions, the provisions that are unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Hart, cannot be severed from those other provisions that would remain valid. We're stating that the first clause of Section 565.020.2, murder in the first degree is a Class A felony, is essentially and inseparably connected with and dependent upon the invalid penalty provisions providing for a penalty of death or life imprisonment without eligibility for probation and parole. Given that both those two penalties, death and life without the possibility for probation and parole, are unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Hart, the argument is that the murder in the first degree statute, Section 565.020, is unenforceable against Mr. Hart, and that his conviction under that first degree murder statute is null and void. Based on that, Mr. Hart is asking that this court discharge him from conviction of murder in the first degree and discharge him from his sentence. Now, recognizing that murder in the first degree is the most serious offense in the state, and also recognizing that it's unlikely that this court or any court would completely discharge him from conviction based on the jury's verdict finding him guilty, Mr. Hart asked in the alternative that this court enter a conviction for murder in the second degree, the lesser included offense. Murder in the second degree is still a murder conviction. He would be subject to a range of punishment of from 10 to 30 years or life. Of any sentence that would be imposed, he would have to serve a mandatory minimum of 85% of that sentence based on a separate statutory section, because murder in the second degree is a dangerous felony. And also, the facts of the particular case actually would support entry of a murder in the second degree conviction, because the victim in the attempted robbery, the victim, Mr. Sindelar, was killed during the course of an attempted robbery in the first degree. Now, the second alternative that Mr. Hart is arguing is that the invalid penalty provisions of Section 565.020.2, that is, those that separate clause that provides for a punishment of death or life imprisonment without eligibility for probation and parole, is in fact severable from the first clause of that same section. We are arguing that the first clause, murder in the first degree is a Class A felony, is not essentially and inseparably connected with or dependent upon the invalid penalty provisions that are in the second clause. Based on this, we're arguing, of course, that severance is appropriate. And the doctrine of severability would state that this court can strike those offending portions of the law while leaving the remaining of the remaining law to survive. In this particular instance, if we sever the invalid punishment provisions, we'll be left with the first clause, which is murder in the first degree is a Class A felony.
Why can't you just sever without parole? Death and without parole.
I think that the provision that provides for without eligibility for probation and parole is, in fact, inseparably connected with life. I think that the statute, when taken, when it's plain and ordinary language, is interpreted that the legislative intent is clear that life would not be a punishment for the offense of murder in the first degree, and I believe that that was the legislature's intention to begin with.
But isn't that same argument applied to leaving Class A felony that has even more lenient punishment?
Well, I think that the first clause, murder in the first degree is a Class A felony, is a provision that the legislature would have enacted even without the invalid penalty provisions. I believe that the legislature would have assigned murder in the first degree, the state's most serious offense, a Class A felony, which is the highest classification that it is. So I do believe that they would have enacted that clause even without the invalid penalty provisions or those penalty provisions that would be unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Hart.
Do you have a response that's different than your predecessors who made the argument as to why the legislature shouldn't be given an opportunity to comply with Miller versus Alabama?
Well, I think that whether or not we give them the opportunity or not, they are going to take it. And during this current legislative session, I'm aware of at least four different bills, one House bill and three Senate bills that attempt to address this problem. I don't know that anything that comes out of the current legislative session would actually affect Mr. Hart's case in the sentence that would be imposed in his case, and that's because any law that was passed this year would not be effective until August 28th of 2013.
What if it had an emergency clause?
It could have an emergency clause. They could decide upon that and make it effective earlier. But as one of the other attorneys pointed out, 1.160 applies and states that the defendant should be tried and punished according to what the law was at the time the offense was committed. Section 1.160 used to, several years ago, include a separate provision that stated that if there was a reduction in penalty pursuant to an amendatory law, that then the defendant would get the benefit of it. But the legislature has since removed that particular provision and amended 1.160 to omit it altogether.
Haven't our case decisions consistently allowed the more lenient statutory penalty to provide if it was available at the time of sentencing?
I don't know what cases this court would be referring to, but I do know that there were a number of cases relying on 1.160 and that provision that has since been repealed that did give defendants the benefit of a reduction in penalty that was in any amended law.
Say you had a robbery, forget this situation, you had a robbery and the law at the time was the maximum sentence was 15 years. And by the time of sentencing, the maximum sentence had been reduced to 10 years. You're saying that the court could still sentence to 15 years and wouldn't be limited to 10?
Well, I'm saying under 1.160.
I'm just asking you generally, under whatever.
Well, Under 1.160, if you were to determine that the range of punishment was a procedural law, then you would apply the procedural law that would be in effect.
Although
at the
if it
time.
Went up, I'm sure then we'd be limited, then there would be an ex post facto law, wouldn't it? And you couldn't raise the. If it was a 5-year penalty and it suddenly went up to 20, I'm confident that the argument would be that you can't retroactively increase the punishment.
Yes.
For a crime.
Now, obviously, if the judge relied on the law as it was effective at the time of sentencing and gave the defendant a reduced penalty or a penalty that would be a reduction under the law, then it would not be something that the defendant and his attorney would challenge.
But is there any other principle in the law that entitles a defendant to a lesser punishment other than the statutory provision that's since been repealed? Because the law generally is someone, the law in effect at the time you commit a crime governs. So is there any legal principle that requires giving a more lenient sentence that's subsequently enacted other than the statute that did it?
Well, I think that perhaps if there was a statute that did provide for retroactivity, then there would be the possibility of the defendant then getting the benefit.
Can you address the issue of whether you can sever a statute that's only partially invalid as applied? Whether severability applies under associated industries?
I think that you can sever the unconstitutional provisions of a statute just so long as they're.
Yeah, but you're not saying you should sever it. You're only saying you sever it for some people, for people who were under 18 at the time of their crime.
Well, I think it would only.
So it reads one way for some people and a different way for others. Can you do that with?
I think that you can because the law that we're dealing with only deals with juveniles, those people who are under the age of 18 at the time that they committed their offenses.
Why do you say that? The 565.020 applies to everybody.
Yes, 565.020 applies to everybody, but Miller v. Alabama does not. And so Miller v. Alabama is the legal premise upon which we would actually undertake the severance itself. And without a ground to actually undertake severance, a legal ground, then we would not make any changes to the statute for other individuals.
Have you looked into the issue? Are there cases that address whether you can say a statute is valid as written as to some people and sever parts of it as applied to other people? That's sort of or do you just have to say it's invalid and strike it down entirely if it's when there's an as-applied challenge like this?
In this particular instance, we have chosen to argue both of the last two things that you stated. We are arguing both that the penalty is unconstitutional and a statute without a penalty is void, so we're arguing that the whole thing should be stricken as it applies to Mr. Hart so that his conviction under the first-degree murder statute is null and void. And then we're also arguing that because the punishment provisions are unconstitutional as applied to him, then seeing that severance could be appropriate and that the statute could be severed under the way the law is currently written, that severance would lead to the clause murder in the first degree as a Class A felony, resulting in a punishment of 10 to 30 years or life for him.
Can you address the issue of sentencing on the other crimes and waiver of jury sentencing?
Yes. In this particular case, Mr. Hart did actually execute a written waiver of jury sentencing, mm-hmm. and he also stated on record that he was waiving jury sentencing. But I think even though the record does not state it, that one can assume that one of the reasons that he did waive jury sentencing was because no matter what was presented in mitigation or no matter what the state actually presented in aggravation, he was going to receive a sentence of life without eligibility for probation and parole because that is what Section 565.020.2 actually mandates. So what we're asking for is the opportunity for jury sentencing
And so, but then he gets jury sentencing on the first degree murder, or the second, if that's what, if that's the alternative we follow. But he got court sentencing on the other charges. Nobody else gets to slice and dice that.
Well, you're saying he gets jury sentencing and everything because he only waived the others because he thought he had life without parole.
I believe I differ in on that issue from other counsel who have argued before you today. I believe I actually requested jury sentencing and resentencing on count one only. So my argument is different from that of Ms. Hathaway, who preceded me in that respect. So I've requested jury sentencing on count one.
Then I'm sorry, I apologize. I interrupted Judge Wilson's question. As you don't normally get to say, I'll pick the jury for this count and the judge for these other counts. You have to do one or the other.
Right. I think that the reason why we're doing jury sentencing on count one is because of, obviously, because of the intervening law, and the punishment for that count was unconstitutional. I think absent,
So you're not asking for resentencing at all. The only thing it's going back on, you're asking for jury sentencing on, because you're not asking that the other convictions be reversed.
I'm asking for jury sentencing on count one only.
Are you asking us to reverse the convictions on the other counts and send them back for resentencing, or are you only asking us to reverse the conviction on count one and send it back for resentencing?
I'm asking for a reversal of count one.
So it's not inconsistent. You're not asking for partial resentencing by the judge and partial by the jury. You're only asking for resentencing on count one.
I'm only asking for resentencing on count one because I feel that there's only a legal basis for some action to be taken on count one.
Well, jury sentencing, your client knew they had a right to jury sentencing, though, right?
The record is clear that he knew he had a right to jury sentencing, that he had received some advice on jury sentencing. But at the time that he made his decision, obviously the only punishment that he could have received at that time was murder. For murder in the first degree would have been a non-parolable life sentence.
You'll have time for rebuttal, so we'll end the time right now. But you'll be back. You'll be back. Go ahead.
May it please the court. On the waiver issue, so this case is a little bit different than the first one you heard. Mr. Hart, in this case, waived jury sentencing just before jury selection began, before he even knew the jury would find him guilty of first-degree murder. And in this case, as in most first-degree murder cases, the jury was instructed both on first- and second-degree murder. So obviously his waiver was not animated by his sense of futility that the only sentence that he could have received was life without parole, since he did not know which crime, if any, the jury would find him guilty of. On severance and associated industries, in that particular case, both parties argued that 1.140 did not apply because it was an as-applied declaration of unconstitutionality. In the court's opinion, the court seemed to go along with the party's description of the case as being an as-applied challenge, but then went on to discuss common law severance and actually applied common law severance in considering severing the provisions that the U.S. Supreme Court found unconstitutional in associated industries. The interesting part about that discussion is this court kept going back to 1.140 to inform its discussion about common law severance and how it was going to apply that in associated industries. And the court found that what it had to do in that case was determine whether the General Assembly would have passed the statute at issue in associated industries, even if it could be only applied in the manner required by the Supreme Court. Applying that in this case, it would seem, based on the legislative history of 565.020, well, the aftermath of what has occurred in the meantime, that we can be fairly confident that the General Assembly would have passed a penalty provision for murder in the first degree for juvenile defendants and included life without parole as an option, but would have included the alternative option if they had known.
But that's not even been proposed. That's not even under consideration. How can we presume they would have passed a statute that says life with or without parole, but not only did they not do it, but they're not even considering it? I mean, we're trying to, doesn't that force us to try to divine what they would do based on bills introduced, things not introduced, based on what we think we would do, but they didn't do it? Don't we have to go to something they have done? It's a rock and a hard place, and we've got to figure it out. It's a conundrum. But I'm not sure how we can't do it on the basis we think this is what they would have done, when there's really, as opposed to we think it's logical for them to do this.
Well, or another part of that argument is we're looking at what they would have done at the time they adopted the statute, not what they might do now.
I think you can look at that. I think you can look at what did they do after the Supreme Court declared that the death penalty cannot be applied to juveniles, which was they left 020 in place. And it's a difficult situation because it's so unique. And a lot of times courts have to try to divine what was the intent of the General Assembly. And I don't know if looking at proposed bills that might be floating around, I guess if we had one that had been agreed to and finally passed,
I'm not saying we should. I'm saying they left life without parole in place. Even if we agreed, we could presume, given what they did before, that they would leave that in place. How do we divine what they would do as an alternative? And how do we pick and choose without ourselves legislating? It's a real issue. You're saying we should pick life, but on what basis do we pick that?
Well, in Associated Industries, the question was, would they have passed this with that limitation if they would have known about Miller? And when the only sentence that they provided for, you know, after Simmons, was life without parole, I think we could be very confident that they wanted that particular sentence. Now, it is classified as a Class A felony, and they knew that there are certain penalty provisions that went along with a Class A felony, but they accepted all of them out except for life without parole and death.
What is there that requires severance? If 1.140 doesn't apply to as-applied cases, then why should this court judicially create a doctrine of severance at all? I mean, well, sometimes judges have to comply with the Constitution without extra material provided from legislators.
Well, I think Associated Industries basically created that. If I don't believe in that case, the idea that an as-applied challenge 1.140 has no application toward. Both parties in that case, for whatever reason, argued that it did not apply because it was an as-applied challenge.
Right.
The court sort of accepted it for purposes of argument and then talked about this common law idea of severance.
Let me ask you a question about that then. Doesn't generally severance apply to substantive constitutional arguments, not procedural constitutional arguments?
Well, it usually seems to be the case.
Because it doesn't. Because in this situation, the substantive constitutional sentence is still available. There are certain things that are required procedurally by the Constitution in order to impose life without parole on a juvenile.
Right.
That doesn't lend itself very well to severance, regardless of what statutory scheme is presented.
That's true, Your Honor. But
where does that leave us? I mean, I know where the state would like to leave us, and I understand, but where does that leave us?
Well, 1.140 and Associated Industries that use that as a model for for the common law idea of severance, and I still don't believe Associated Industries completely ruled out the possibility that 1.140.
But you're not really severing at all. You're adding, because you're saying this is constitutional. Just as written, it just has to have an alternative. We should put it in. Because you're not really asking us even to sever as applied or not.
Well, it's there. The language is there. Murder in the first degree is a Class A felony.
You're asking us to create an alternative that's not. Yeah, Class A felony. I understand that. You could, but then you have to sever it for. Then you wouldn't have life without parole if you severed off the back part. That's certainly one alternative you talk about. But you're saying don't sever that. Leave that in. But then kind of cut and paste the first part as an alternative. And I've just never seen a case that suggests that's a severance principle, or that we could do it.
And we never seen a, have never seen a case like Miller. And the Supreme Court even said that there's not been a case like Miller, and the two junctions of this law came together, according to the court's opinion in Miller. Why we have severance, and why the General Assembly didn't, after Associated Industries, did not amend 1.140 to demonstrate any ire with what the court was trying to do in that case with the common law idea of severance. The idea of severance is it's the General Assembly asking courts to not allow a gap in the law to be created because of an unforeseen circumstance that later occurred when a court declares part or all of a statute.
Of course, isn't that where they're free to consider and adopt a new law and apply it retroactively? But if they don't, do we get to perform that role for them?
I think that 1.140 allows the court, as an invitation for the court to perform that role as a stopgap. Certainly if they pass a new statute to be applied forward, that would be what would obviously apply. But in the meantime, there is this gap in the law and a vacuum. 1.140 is basically a legislative declaration that the legislature abhors vacuums as much as courts do.
Before your time's up, I want you to address another issue. You suggested that on remand, it's not necessary for the jury to consider all the factors set out in Miller, even though about five different places they say it's mandatory, and you rely on a State versus Riley decided by the Connecticut Court of Appeals that you said found that, well, it's up to the defendant, they just have to have a chance to introduce evidence. But that was a case where death was not mandatory, neither death nor life without parole were mandatory. Their statute had sentencing by the court, and the sentence was for a term of years, and in that case, the person got a term of years sentence, and the Supreme Court has taken a transfer of that case on that issue. So I'm not sure how that is relevant guidance for the Connecticut Supreme Court has taken transfer on that case.
What we cited that case for was the proposition that, and this came more from the amicus brief, that this court should devise a whole set of rules to govern.
But that was your one example of saying a court has said you don't have to have guidelines for the jury to consider. See, they don't have to in Connecticut. But there, that's because there were statutes setting out those guidelines already, and it was for the court to consider in deciding what term of years to impose. So it's not really very similar to our case.
Well, and the reason why we believe that case is applicable is we do have a statute, Chapter 557, bifurcated sentencing. We can't use the Chapter 565 sentencing provision because, you know, it's for death and presumes that the only available other penalty is life without parole, which cannot be applied to juveniles. So we have in Chapter 557, we have bifurcated sentencing, and it talks about the attendant circumstances, that the jury can consider that, the nature and character.
I thought you were saying we didn't need to tell the jury what it needed to consider, but perhaps I misunderstood your argument. I understood you to say you would not tell the jury the factors they should consider.
I don't think.
And there they have a statute that tells the court what factors to consider, and they found that was adequate under Miller.
And I think the statute under Chapter 557 is adequate. And this, that coupled with what Miller states is adequate, that this court does not need to devise or create a set of standards that a jury must consider in a first-degree murder case for a juvenile, that 557, along with Miller, does exactly that.
Counsel,
yes.
While you've still got a little yellow light left, Miller said that the juvenile could be given life without parole if the jury or fact finder was properly instructed and considered the evidence that Miller discusses, correct?
Yeah, what I believe Miller says is that life without parole cannot be statutorily mandated, and that the court then went on to talk about, but there was obviously no holding on those particular cases about what factors, how significant each individual factor is and what must be shown before a life without parole sentence can.
Could a properly instructed jury give Mr. Hart life without probation or parole? Assuming he had an opportunity to introduce all of the evidence that would be relevant to the Miller factors.
Sure. And I hate to say this, but because I don't want to create any more discussion that's necessary, I think this court could decide he's waived jury sentencing. If this was up to the judge, that this court could decide based on the facts of this case, and the same with the first case, based on the facts of that case, looking at Miller, that a life without parole sentence was the appropriate sentence in this case. In effect, taking the place, rather than having a remand, taking the place of the circuit court judge. I don't think there's anything in Miller that would prevent that.
That's interesting.
Unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Beckheim, thank you very much for your double duty. It's like a double header for you.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Ms. Robinson.
I would like to address a couple of the arguments. He indicated that there would be no infirmity or problem with this court actually making the determination on its own that a term of life imprisonment without the possibility of probation and parole was accurate in this particular instance. And I do think that there is an infirmity in that presumption. And that is that the factors that I discussed at the very beginning of my oral argument were not put forth before this court, and it would take away from the judge the discretion that the trial judge has in sentencing a defendant.
What about this issue, though, that your client waived jury sentencing, and he did it before he was found guilty of first-degree murder? If he knew he had the right to jury sentencing, and he waived it before he knew what he was convicted of, why didn't he waive it for good?
Well, as I stated before, at that particular time that he made his decision to waive his jury sentencing, he definitely did not know that the punishment for murder in the first degree, which was mandatory, the one that he was going to receive, life imprisonment.
How did he know he was going to get convicted of first degree murder as opposed to second degree murder? How did he know that?
Well, he didn't know that he was going to be convicted of murder in the first degree, and there was a felony murder instruction submitted at his trial. But he did know at the time that murder in the first degree, he knew he was going to get life imprisonment without the possibility of probation and parole. Who knows what his attorney told him, since he was counseled as to the issue, about the possibility of coming away with a verdict of murder in the second degree versus a verdict of murder in the first degree. What we do know is at that particular time, he did not know that the mandated punishment for murder in the first degree would be unconstitutional as applied to him.
But he sure knew that the punishment for murder in the second degree was less than life without parole, and he yet chose not to have the jury consider that.
How's that any different than the cases where the U.S. Supreme Court has required additional things in order to receive the death penalty? And the defendant waived jury sentencing before he went to trial, and then later has tried to base the the fact that his waiver was not knowing and voluntary because he couldn't have anticipated certain findings would be required or other procedural mechanisms would be necessary?
Well, I think it would differ in this instance because we're not talking about particular findings. We're talking about that the actual penalty that he was going to receive for murder in the first degree was going to be found unconstitutional and him not having any foreknowledge of that. Moving on, I did want to state that I do think that in determining legislative intent, this court is to look at what the legislative intent was at the time of the statute's enactment, and not what the legislative intent may be today in terms of what the punishment would be for a juvenile who's convicted of murder in the first degree who's under the age of 18 at the time of his crimes. I have no further and would just request that the court take into consideration the alternative arguments that I've made today.
Ms. Robinson, excellent job. Thank you very much. We'll take the case under submission.